At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You're all rested, right? After the holidays, got your fill of family and good tidings. That's great, because the economy, it's as surly as ever. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 6th of January today, Tuesday. Glad you could be with us. Although, in the spirit of the season gone by, I wish we had happier things to tell you. Nobody likes to start a new year playing economic catch-up, but here we are. I'll give you a quick rundown of the numbers du jour, and then Bob Moon's going to take it from there. Item one is factories. The Commerce Department said today orders to American factories fell for a record fourth straight month in November. And then this afternoon, right on cue, Alcoa, the aluminum maker, said it's going to cut more than 13,000 jobs. Item two is housing. So you know this isn't going to be good. The National Association of Realtors reported today pending home sales have dropped to their lowest on record. And remember, that's from the industry's lobbying group, not an organization prone to negative spin. There was, I should say, a bright spot amid the gloom and doom. A trade group said there were some new orders and an improved employment picture for the services sector, which accounts for a huge chunk of the economy. So with all that as prologue, here's Bob.
Today's numbers seem to take us two more steps back, but one little step forward. While manufacturing and housing declined again, some economists saw hope in an unexpectedly upbeat reading from the Institute for Supply Management. Its index of activity in the service sector actually rose, and that's where most Americans have their jobs. But economist Joel Naroff found that only slightly encouraging.
The ISM number wasn't necessarily a sign that things are getting better. It just means that the economy is not crashing and burning as rapidly as it had been.
Still, Naroff says you have to stop falling before you can get back up. And at Principal Global Investors, economist Bob Bauer agrees.
You don't just go from all bad data to all positive data, so we view that it's a positive to move to where the data is at least mixed.
Others aren't so optimistic. Barry Ritholtz is director of equity research at Fusion IQ. He cautions against focusing too much on a single month just because it's the most recent.
You'll get all excited about last month's data because it was a little better than expected.
Ritholtz also discounts the stock market's spin on the news.
I don't think the economists on Wall Street have done investors much of a favor by implying that things are, you know, all sugar and spice when it's not.
Still, economist Bob Bauer argues that Wall Street's reaction is at least a welcome change.
We wouldn't expect this as the beginning of a bull market, but at least having the stock market no longer crash every time there's some bad economic data is positive news.
Remember, though, as the fine print often cautions, Wall Street's current performance is no guarantee of future results. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It's not unusual to squabble over the natural gas bill this time of year. Somebody turns the thermostat up, somebody else turns it down, trying to save a couple of pennies, like in my house. But not many disputes end up with a whole country declaring a state of emergency and several others warning of major fuel shortages. The disagreement in question is between Russia and Ukraine. The two have been wrangling for years over the price of natural gas and over an unpaid bill. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from the European desk in London that a large part of Europe is now feeling the draft.
Bulgaria has been hit the worst and could run out of natural gas within days. Romania, Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic have also been affected. Slovakia's in a state of national emergency. And all because Ukraine won't pay the price that Russia's Gazprom is demanding. Analyst Julian Lee.
Gazprom says, therefore, it doesn't have a contract to supply Ukraine and it has no option but to cease delivering gas to Ukraine.
And that, says Lee, has affected supplies to up to a dozen other customers down the line. Gazprom says it's not to blame.
It is continuing, it says, to put gas through the pipelines that cross Ukraine for delivery to consumers in Europe. However, it accuses Ukraine of having taken some of that gas out of the pipeline for its own use.
Ukraine denies it and says the whole pipeline network has been malfunctioning since Gazprom turned off its supply. But Ukraine has its critics. Nick McGregor is with brokers Redmayne Bentley. He says the Russians are being reasonable.
Countries such as Ukraine and Belarus were paying a tiny fraction of the market price. So really what the Russians are trying to do is bring them into line with something that's a little bit more commercially viable.
McGregor doesn't believe the dispute will drag on. Gazprom cannot afford to upset its European customers for long. They pay full price. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Crude oil closed up today. It touched $50 a barrel at one point, but that is still not good enough for Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Chavez is running short on cash as crude is getting cheaper. Just yesterday, he ended a program that offered cheap heating oil to low-income Americans. Oil analysts had been predicting Chavez's cash crunch. They even invented a parlor game about it. They called it the magic number, where if the price of a barrel of oil drops below it, the Venezuelan government goes into the red. From the Marketplace America's desk at WLRN, Dan Gretsch reports the magic may be over.
There's a new parlor game being played by Venezuelan oil economists. It's called the magic date. That's the moment when Venezuela runs out of money.
Just like we ask, what's the break-even number? What is the magic number? The magic date is going to be the second quarter of 2009.
That's Jorge Piñon with the Center for Hemispheric Policy in Miami.
Then I think that we are in front of a total collapse of the Venezuelan economy.
The magic date depends, of course, on the price of crude. But if oil stays cheap, experts say Venezuela will burn through its savings sometime in 2009. Chavez has promised $30 billion to his allies all across Latin America.
This list of things that they wanted to do, both domestically and overseas, was huge. And now when they finally have to go and pay for that list to Santa Claus, the money is not there.
President Chavez recently went back on his commitment to build refineries in Nicaragua and Ecuador. That could be just the beginning. Cuba expert Brian Littell wrote the book After Fidel. He says the last thing to go will be Venezuela's massive oil subsidy to Cuba, to the tune of 100,000 free barrels of oil a day. That's because in return, Cuba provides President Chavez with revolutionary street cred.
Hugo Chavez is the heir, the acolyte, the direct descendant of Fidel. He calls Fidel Father Fidel. And as long as Fidel is alive, Chavez would be very, very, very reluctant to cut Cuba.
Inside Venezuela, the state oil company spends $13 billion a year on handouts, like discounted food, free medical care, and subsidized gasoline. Venezuelan drivers pay just 12 cents a gallon, but don't expect that to change. Hugo Chavez's predecessor was overthrown in part because he tried to play with the price at the pump. Piñon says pricey oil and all the goodies it bought kept Chavez popular over the past decade.
Low oil prices are going to be the catalyst that is going to bring this revolution to its knees because it's overspent.
He says cheap crude could do what U.S. foreign policy couldn't, usher in a new president of Venezuela. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
There was a little bit of magic on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. today, Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis showed why he's still got a company to run while so many of his former peers don't. Lewis is smart enough not to ask for a bonus. He told the board today he's not interested in extra money after the bank's performance last year. Of course, 2008 wasn't all bad for B of A. It managed to snap up its Wall Street competition, Merrill Lynch, and what is arguably the company at the heart of the mortgage mess, Countrywide Financial. Adam Michelson used to run marketing at Countrywide, helping generate new customers for what was, at the time, the biggest mortgage firm in the United States. He has written about his experiences in a new book. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let's frame this in terms of timing. I mean, you started at Countrywide before any of us had ever heard the word subprime.
Well, you know, it's funny. I myself had not heard that much about Countrywide when I interviewed with them. And there's a portion of the book where I go through the scene by which I was being interviewed. And the sparkle in their eyes when they mentioned the dream of home ownership. And this was not like marketing toys or candy or technology. This was selling the American dream.
What was it about this sense of purpose that you guys had that got us to where we are today? I mean, there was a mentality there that comes through in your book of we got to get people into homes, and this is why we are on this planet.
I speak a lot about Angelo Mozillo, the CEO of Countrywide, and he's been vilified in many ways in the press. But the man was a hero to many of us in the business. And before the crisis came to pass, for 40 years, he helped people get into homes that perhaps they could not have gotten before. When he walked the halls, it was like Walt Disney walking the halls and touching your shoulder and telling you that you were doing good for America. So there was a certain paternal pathos there that was infectious. And I'll tell you, at the time, and I'm sure many people can think back when their housing values were skyrocketing and everybody was getting rich and everything was great, we all honestly believed in the mission that he espoused.
Here you are, though, a guy whose job it is to get more people signed on to Countrywide's products.
There's moral ambiguity inherent in all selling. In fact, I would argue that many of your readers, any of whom have ever been involved in sales, have at one time wondered whether that prospect should be buying that product or could buy that product. But they have goals to make, and their job is to sell whatever it is they're selling.
One thing, though, to be selling lawnmowers, it's another thing to be putting somebody who everybody knows can't really afford it into a $500,000 house.
Well, that kind of point of view is a very valid point of view. It's also a populist point of view. But using that argument, we as a nation should decide to vilify fast food companies.
And we do.
And credit card companies who offer new credit cards to people who owe $50,000 in household debt.
And we do.
So it's a much larger issue about not only the morality of selling, but is it more about the death of personal responsibility? It's important for us to question, was every foreclosed homeowner really a victim? Was every corporation really evil? I think the answer is much bigger than that.
What is the answer then? I mean, I'm not going to let you get away with just saying, well, we have to question these things because the economy's in tatters in large part because of what a company like Countrywide did.
Well, part of the reason I wrote the book is because I started to read stories about foreclosed homeowners and how corporations were all evil. And I said, wait a minute. I was in the room and I'm telling you, we were not out to hurt people. Everyone truly believed in the mission of home ownership as a good thing for America.
I'm a big one for reading the acknowledgement section of a book. And the last word, actually, in this book, in your acknowledgements, is, and finally to Angelo Mozillo, for creating Countrywide in the first place and for pushing us all at one time to believe. It doesn't really sound like you regret what happened at Countrywide.
Anyone in their right mind regrets what has happened. But to vilify every loan that's ever been created by any company in this business, I believe, is the same rush to judgment that has gotten us into this crisis in the first place. And now that same rush to judgment is helping us blame people quickly without the full view of the story.
Adam Michelson used to be a senior vice president of marketing at Countrywide, the mortgage company. His book is called The Foreclosure of America. Adam, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
If Congress gives him everything he's asking for, Barack Obama is going to wind up spending hundreds of billions of dollars on infrastructure. That could prop up the economy and create jobs in a hurry. But building and repairing all those roads and bridges is going to require lots of asphalt, the black sticky stuff that holds together more than 90% of our roads. Trouble is, there may not be enough of it to go around, as Joel Rose reports.
I'm driving on Interstate 295 south of Trenton, New Jersey. This is an older concrete roadway, and as you can hear, it's starting to wear out in places. This road would be among the first to be repaved if New Jersey gets the money it's requested from a federal infrastructure spending bill.
We could begin awarding contracts for these as soon as we have funds to do that.
New Jersey Department of Transportation spokeswoman Erin Fallon says there are more than $300 million worth of shovel-ready paving projects in her state alone. Nationwide, there are thousands of miles of road and bridge work just waiting for federal money. But all those projects depend on one extremely volatile commodity, asphalt. Last summer, the price nearly tripled in some places, which forced states all over the country to cancel paving projects. Since then, the price of asphalt has been falling almost as fast.
The tail that wags the dog is the price of crude.
Ben Teplitz covers the asphalt industry for the trade publication Platts Oilgram. Asphalt is made from oil, specifically the heavy stuff at the bottom of the barrel. Teplitz says refiners are typically more focused on making gasoline because that's usually where the money is. Not right now.
The last time I checked, it did not pay to make gasoline, but it paid to make asphalt. The difference was over $13 a barrel.
So the last thing you'd expect is refiners to cut their asphalt production. But that seems to be exactly what many are doing. Before the price of oil collapsed, gasoline refiners started investing billions of dollars in new machines called cokers that can squeeze even more gas out of a barrel of crude. Still, there's at least one company that's sticking with asphalt. Mike Pesch is vice president for refining at New Star Energy. He's driving me around an asphalt refinery in Paulsboro, New Jersey, just across the river from Philadelphia.
For asphalt plants, this is the largest on-purpose plant in the United States. We have another refinery in Savannah, Georgia. It's number two, or pretty close to number two in size.
NuStar bought both of those refineries last year for upwards of $450 million. The Paulsboro plant alone pumps out more than 70,000 barrels of asphalt a day, enough to supply much of the asphalt for eastern Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York City. Standing in front of a jumble of pipes and smokestacks, Pesch is hoping this plant will soon be pushed to capacity.
The United States overall has a net shortage of around 20,000 barrels a day of asphalt. If these projects come in as we're seeing them come in, you're looking at a potential extra demand in the United States for around 250,000 barrels a day.
Pesch hopes that will keep asphalt refiners in the black for years to come. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Coming up, say you're staying at a fancy hotel, paying big bucks, and you see a sign that says this.
The majority of others did reuse their towels sometime during their stay.
What are you going to do? I guess we'll do the numbers. Never mind those lackluster economic readings. We top the program with Wall Street investors. We're betting on the new administration's stimulus plans today. That'll help push the Dow Industrials up 62 points, two-thirds of 1%. Closed at 9,015, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ climbed 24 points, 1.5%, finished at 1652. The S&P 500 advanced 7 points, three-quarters percent. Wrapped up the trading day at 934. High hopes for that forthcoming stimulus package had investors banking on financial stocks in a big way. Citigroup shares and stock in CIT Group profited more than 5%. Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase rang up more than 2% today. Detroit got its jump start from stimulus speculation. Ford shares raced up nearly 7%. General Motors stock gained more than 6%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, the email marketing service dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. ConstantContact.com. One.
Want more from Marketplace's special fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee discusses green technology and economic recovery. President Bush and President-elect Barack Obama lunch with former Presidents Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton at the White House. And on January 7, 1927, the first transatlantic commercial telephone service was established between New York and London. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We're going to start letters today with some definitions. First, astronomy. From Merriam-Webster's, it's the study of objects and matter outside the Earth's atmosphere. Astrology, the supposed influences of the stars and planets on human affairs. And humor. Something that is, or is designed to be, amusing. See also, on occasion, Marketplace. Our mailbox has been overflowing with comments about a story we aired last week connecting astrology and this country's economic fate. While cyber debates about Pluto and Capricorn and why that story ran at all raged on, Tracy Bushman of Salt Lake City, Utah, wrote to say she thought most people missed the point entirely.
What's more appalling or disappointing? Astrological predictions about a hopeful future for our country, or the rampant corruption and greed that drove some of us to need hope like this?
Commentator Tim Evanson raised blood pressures, too. Tim said that at 28 years old, he's thinking retirement's not really a possibility for him, so he's pretty much ready to work till he drops. Tom Morford of Peru, Illinois, and a whole bunch of others said such a youngin has no idea what he's talking about.
You seem to think that your body and mind are going to stay the same, that you will have the choices that you have now. As you pass through the decades ahead, think back to when you wrote this, and I am certain that you will just have to shake your head and admit, I had no clue.
This was clearly a generational thing, though. Here's 30-year-old Devin Martin from Oakland, California.
I, too, am fine with the concept Social Security probably won't be there for me. It's there for my mom, who's just entered retirement, and that's good enough. I'm far more concerned with access to health care and, of course, keeping the dollar and our overall economy solvent for my grandkids.
Speaking of grandkids, commentator Robert Reich has one now. On New Year's Eve, he mentioned how the birth of little Ella during the worst economic downturn of his life, and hopefully hers, has made him realize what's really important. Kitty Bennett of St. Pete Beach, Florida, said right on.
We've lost 40% of our savings, and yes, it is a bummer, but his point about how having grandkids changes your outlook is one I really need to keep reminding myself of.
And finally, from the Marketplace desk of You Learn Something New Every Single Day, last week we brought you a story about the acronyms of 2008. We talked about TARP and ARMS and FDIC, which some of you pointed out is where we went wrong. It seems FDIC is an initialism, not an acronym. Initials are just that. We say the initials. Acronyms apparently spell a word like scuba or radar. If you've got a correction for us, a compliment, or an FYI about our coverage, go ahead and tell us. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Habits can be hard to change, especially later in life. But when it comes to fixing our bad environmental habits, it might be time to go back to high school. There's a growing body of research that shows peer pressure may be the most effective way to get people to behave in a more eco-friendly manner. That's opposed, of course, to the classic do-gooder appeals that are so common in the environmental movement. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Noah Goldstein has a Ph.D. in social psychology. He teaches at the prestigious Anderson School of Management at UCLA and tosses around esoteric terms like injunctive norm. But today, he's talking hotel towels.
There are these signs in hotels that ask people to reuse their towels to help save the environment.
That's the standard environmental appeal. The Ph.D.s thought they could do better.
A second one that we created specifically informed guests that the majority of others did reuse their towels sometime during their stay.
The result of that message, 26% more recycling. And when Goldstein and his colleagues tweaked the sign further to say the majority of guests in that particular room had reused their dirty towels, recycling improved 33%. Goldstein says it's an adaptive, herd-like response.
If you go to a cafeteria and you've never been there before and nobody is touching the ham and everybody is touching the turkey, it's probably effective for you to go for the turkey sandwich instead of the ham.
Now, some energy businesses are starting to apply the research on peer influence. Alex Lasky heads Positive Energy, a company that helps utilities cut their customers' energy use. He's read the latest studies, and he's a believer.
Despite the fact that your mother and my mother told us countless times that it doesn't matter what the neighbors do, I set the rules in this house. It turns out, at the end of the day, we are all driven by what our perception of what the neighbors are doing.
One of Lasky's clients is Puget Sound Energy, a utility in suburban Seattle.
We know today that if our customers in Western Washington did pretty attainable energy efficiency measures, going to CFLs, doing some upgrades around the house, we wouldn't have to build two 250-megawatt gas-fired power plants.
That's PSE's Andy Wappler. He says the utility just started a pilot program. It's telling 40,000 of its customers how much energy they use compared to neighbors in similar-sized houses. The initial response? Well, let's just say the customer calls were charged.
I have to say they were 100% negative. They were people that were offended by them and felt that it was an invasion of privacy, and how dare we suggest they should be doing better.
That's PSE employee Christy Neese. She took hundreds of calls in the first few days. Still, only 19 of those overusers asked to opt out of the pilot program. The results of the utility's peer pressure project aren't in yet, but the success of a similar academic experiment in Southern California gives the utility confidence. Enter the home of PSE customer John Gagas.
In the kitchen, there's probably 8 bulbs there. There's 4 in here. There's
Gagas found out he's actually out saving his neighbors.
My reaction was good. My other reaction was I can do better.
Gagas may not know it, but the tendency for good performers like him is to backslide when they find out they're better than average. Behavioral scientists call this moving to the magnetic middle. That's why PSE plastered 2 smiley faces next to Gagas's positive score. The research suggests that kind of kindergarten approval can prevent behavioral relapse. So what symbol do the energy hogs get?
We don't give them frowns. Nobody wants a frown.
That's apparently another social theory PSE subscribes to. At some point, the customer's always right. In King County, Washington, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note echoes of a scandal gone by. A federal appeals court ruled today that former Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling is still guilty, but he might be in line for a lighter sentence. Skilling was convicted on 19 counts of conspiracy and fraud almost 3 years ago. The ruling today said the trial judge misapplied federal sentencing guidelines. Until he does get a new hearing, Skilling is serving his existing 24-year term at a minimum security prison in Colorado. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 62 points, 2/3%. The NASDAQ closed up 24 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 was also up 7 points, 3/4%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. The morning show is where you should tune tomorrow early for the latest on the fallout from the financial crisis. Coming up next time on this program, the economy is making a whole lot of people real nervous.
Probably 3 or 4 times a week, I wake up after a horrible dream. I dream that I'm being chased. I've dreamed that my boyfriend married someone else and left me.
Stress and the economy. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.